This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. In terms of Southeast Asian art, Indonesia's Raden Saleh and Juan Luna from the Philippines are two names that have great historical significance. John Clark, who is Professor Emeritus in Art History at the University of Sydney, is presenting a lecture tomorrow at Ilham Gallery comparing the two painters and their significance to both colonial and national histories in this region. John joins me today via Skype. In regards to the lecture that you're about to give over the weekend, could you perhaps contextualize for me Raden Saleh and Juan Luna?
So Raden Saleh is very important because I think it's 1834, if I remember rightly. He's the first Asian artist, with one exception in the 18th century in London, to exhibit at a European salon. And that's after 5 years of training in studios of two Dutch artists. He didn't go to art school. He could have done, but the Dutch colonial authorities didn't send him to art school. And so, in a certain sense, he's the first colonized artist to not only to get some kind of training in a studio in Europe, but also to appear in a European salon. And there's various comments in the Dutch press at the time about this, but not the firstness of it. He's there, and isn't it strange or wonderful that the Javanese can do this? And then he also appeared, he managed to stay in Europe for quite a long time, until 1852 or 3, I just haven't got the dates in front of me. And he was also one of the first Asian artists to exhibit at the various official salons in Paris in 1846 or 47, and was recognized as such because the then French head of state bought one of his paintings. Unfortunately, it's buried away in a town hall somewhere and you can't get at it very easily, but, you know, a grand thing with a man on the back of it, engaged in a chase in Java, an animalier picture of the kind. I mean, he's not only mastering various kinds of painting, he's also been accepted as having mastered it by Europeans. And the second thing, which has never really been properly given its due with about Raden Saleh, is that he must have known a great deal about European painting, which was being done at the time, because the famous painting of the capture of Diponangara, which he did back in Java, was the painting from a trope. That's to say, there's already been an established trope of history painting, and already a Dutch painter had done a picture of the capture of Diponangara. So he did this only history painting that we know of, that he did, against the Dutch, but he also sent it back to the Dutch king. So there's this sort of resistant nature of a colonized artist already there at the very, very beginning of these sorts of artists who are then found all over different parts of Asia. Juan Luna is different. Juan Luna was trained, he first of all trained as a naval pilot. He trained as a pilot, the ship, you know, the person who guides ships into harbor.
Right, right.
Coming from actually a tax collector's family, but they moved from the countryside to Manila. And he came to study art at the second major art school in the Philippines. The first had been established by a Chinese Filipino called Damian Domingo in the 1820s. But this was a school which was actually founded by the city of Manila and was funded by the Catholic, by the colonial authorities. So he had a very comprehensive, if in his own terms, very boring, training in academy practice even before he left the Philippines. And he left the Philippines following or going along with his brother, who was a talented violinist, to Madrid. And alongside his brother training at the conservatorium in Madrid, he himself trained in the Academy of the Royal Academy of Arts, the one which has many paintings still today by Goya. But he didn't like them, and he thought that he'd seen the same sorts of things in Manila. So he went off with his teacher to Rome. And Rome is probably as important a site for 19th century Academy painting as Paris is, but it's never really been properly examined, I think. But certainly there were three Filipino artists and a couple of writers in Rome. And of course, because they were in Rome, they spoke, they could find their way around Italian, and one presumes anyway, fairly quickly. But he then came back from Rome to Manila with this grand picture, which is in the fashion of the time for Roman subjects, but very, very large picture, and won the gold medal at the Royal Academy exhibitions in Madrid. So here again, we have an artist in a very different way, by a very different route, and talking about Sfogliari, which is a fine grand machine, as they would be called in those days. But nevertheless, I mean, he got recognition from the Spanish elite. He didn't get the first prize, which was above the gold prize, but still, it was a very direct recognition of his ability in Madrid. And after Madrid, he moved to Paris, and then from Paris, he moved to back to Spain and was involved in various attempts to liberate the Philippines from Spain. I think initially you have to say by a sort of assimilationist representation in the Cortes and so forth, the movement of that, but it didn't work. And he'd forgotten or hadn't realized the strength of the opposition to such movements by the Spanish clergy, who were, as we saw continuously from the 19th century through to the end of Franco, in fact, a very reactionary force in Spanish politics altogether.
The lecture that you are presenting in Ilham, it's basically a comparative lecture of Radin Saleh and Juan Luna. Why do you think there's merit in comparing these two painters?
Well, because they to some extent, they're very different. I mean, after all, Juan Luna spends the last 5 years of his life as a, if not a revolutionary, then a representative of the independent Spanish Philippine government. You know, I mean, he's definitely on the side of the angels politically, whereas Radin Saleh doesn't really care for that. And indeed, earlier on in his career, he sort of thought that the cultural prejudice against people who become qualified in Holland when they went back to Java was stood against him, and there's various things like that in the bits of his writing that we have. And he also half thought that he was going to become a cosmopolitan in Europe. The problem is the different attitudes to cosmopolitanism, which we could say is a multilinguality and multi-sighting in social elites, at the very least, if not competence in different art styles. They were very different in their relationship to that issue. Juan Luna, on the other hand, changed his style. He went through about four changes of style, at least on certain subject matters. He changed his style to eventually, in the early 1890s, before he became involved in politics, it seems, to depict the Italian working population. There were lots of immigrant laborers in Paris at that time.
So your lecture actually focuses on two specific paintings, The Arrest of Diponegoro by Radin Saleh and also Spoliarium by Juan Luna.
I didn't make them the focal point of the lecture, but I had to have a key to get people interested, and these were the two paintings that I probably heard of.
So what do painters like Radin Saleh and Juan Luna, what kind of significance do they hold today at a time when we're trying to build a more cohesive Southeast Asian identity?
Well, I think I better leave Southeast Asian identity to the Southeast Asians. and anyway, I'm more interested in Asian interactions or Asian parallels, if there's some interaction. And Southeast Asian identity is the latest version of narrow self-focus in Priscilla societies, which
totally understandable in a certain sense, agreeable from a political point of view, but don't make a great deal of sense with art, I'm afraid. Politically acceptable, both within the academy and outside the academy, but, you know, after side and so forth. Artists don't work that way. The artists are not concerned in pushing the identity of their work as it, they didn't have a concept in the 19th century anyway, really, of post-colonial state. So post-colonial projections are really that. It doesn't look at what the artists did. Of course, artists were working against the colony, there's no doubt about that, and they were trying to steal ideas from the colonizer. Why not? But they're working in a special kind of space which we don't really understand. I mean, many of our ideas about the 19th century are just wrong. The idea that the Dutch imposed academy style on the Indonesians is wrong. There wasn't an academy for a start for them to be trained in Indonesia. And secondly, European society before, shall we say, 1870, before the Franco-Prussian War, was very cosmopolitan. I mean, right until they spoke, in addition to Bahasa and Dutch, Indonesian, I should say, and Dutch, he spoke English, French, and probably Spanish, you know. I mean, anyway, certainly English and French. I mean, these are people who are very, very sophisticated about cultural difference and moving between cultural differences, and very widely accepted at certain points by the elites with which they're in. Our view of colonial cultural encounters is basically the last 50 years of the 19th century, some way between, I suppose, the suppression of the Indian War of Liberation in 1857 and Conrad's stories about the Congo.
I'm speaking to John Clark from the University of Sydney, a professor of art history who specializes in Asian art, about the painters Radin Saleh and Juan Luna. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Front Row on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. I'm speaking to John Clark, Professor Emeritus in Art History from the University of Sydney. John will be presenting a lecture tomorrow, the 19th of May, at Ilham Gallery, called Radin Saleh and Juan Luna, A Comparative Perspective. I find it quite interesting that both Radin Saleh and Juan Luna, their paintings sit at this intersection between colonialism and nationalism, and those are often uneasy bedfellows. How do we approach the paintings and their works today?
Well, we try and look at it the other way around. We try and look at this little boy from Java who'd learnt drawing with a Dutch naturalist, travelling around, going to Holland and learning to draw. In fact, he didn't do a proper academy training, Radin Saleh didn't anyway. He did studio stuff. I think they thought he was going to be a picture restorer, and he learned gilding, for example, frame pictures. And so his pictorial explorations are really, although they're inside stylistics which we identify, they're really his own. They're not imposed on him. He's, of course, people work inside art worlds which have conventions, and that makes their use of those conventions look as if it's imposed on them. Certainly there's certain limitations about, because of that. How many imitations of Picasso do we know from Asia after, say, 1925? Well, a very large number. Their relationship to Picasso is not a colonial relationship, I suppose. So, I mean, these are things artists do with art fashions, what they know the upper class will buy and what the people have painted or made or sculpted. Artists run a, you know, very interesting in-between space. So they're not the imprint, you know, of the times, unless it's particularly obnoxious and oppressive. And all those colonialisms weren't the same. I mean, you know, if you live in Malaysia, you know very well that the sending of the Malaysian artists to be trained in as teachers before they were trained as artists in the 1950s is quite unlike the Indian experience of four art schools before the end of the 1850s, by the 1920s, all except one had Indian heads of school. Any different relationship to art styles and how they circulate and how artists are trained in them than you find in Malaysia or indeed in Indonesia until the early 1950s. This difference has consequences for these people.
So do we look at the paintings of Raden Saleh Juan Luna as nationalist paintings at all?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, yes, of course, they can be so constructed. And yes, of course, they were painted in opposition to the status quo of their time. If there hadn't been a painting of the arrest of Diponegoro by a Dutch painter, I forget his name now, in 10 or 15 years earlier, then you wouldn't perhaps see Raden Saleh producing his picture in a spirit of opposition, but he's saying it's a different reality, man. It's not what you think it is. And as Bernd Klaus very clearly, very interestingly demonstrated by the positioning of the figures and by the nature of the facial representation of the Dutch general who was arresting him, this is also, you may have got us now, but we're actually more civilized than you, more on a higher road to something spiritual than you. And it's in the picture. I think so anyway. I agree with Werner Krauss's arguments.
What will the focus of the talk be? What do you hope that the audience takes away from it?
Oh, that they take away the fact that history is very complicated and very much richer than nationalist constructions.
In many ways, though, with a painter like Luna, it's especially given that, he goes on to become a revolutionary and so on, it's easy.
Well, I don't say revolutionary is the right word, but we use it.
Yes.
Loosely, I think he was a reformist independentist.
Right.
That's all English, yeah.
So for someone like Luna, who has a great sort of national significance and a place within not just the art world but also Filipino ideas of independence and so on, it's kind of easy to be co-opted into that narrative, of that nationalistic narrative, isn't it?
Is it a narrative? I mean, is he being co-opted into a narrative? Is it a story that the Philippines is telling itself through his pictures? Well, that's up to the Filipinos. And is that what Juan Luna is doing? I don't know. I mean, I think Juan Luna is talking about a certain kind of humanistic identification with his subjects. Mm. And sometimes it's a highly ironical picture. You remember the picture of the woman, what's called in French, demi-mondaine, a kind of prostitute, a bit more than a prostitute, in a cafe with three blokes at the... I mean, you don't paint a picture like that without it being... in some way, a kind of comment on the situation. I think that's, artists aren't monodirectional. They do different kinds of things, or at least they do the same kind of things with different kinds of intentions at different times. Mm. And good painters, good artists, including sculptors, of course, are tied up with the métier. They are interested in how their painting works. I mean, Bruno Luna is certainly interested in how his painting works. I mean, and I think a lot of the Filipino artists were, so...
Who were some of the primary influences for these painters of that time who come from Southeast Asia but got so much of training in Europe?
This is a difficult question. It really depends on their access to what they thought was influential. So, very clearly... Raden Saleh did a number on the two Dutch painters he worked with in their studios and then left it behind. To some extent, you can see it later in his nature paintings, paintings of the Great North Road and so forth across Java. But I think he's more interested in human relationships, which allow him the excuse of, or become the excuse for pictorial expression. And he's quite, lots of portraying. He's very, very neutral about the people they portray, because they're looking at the human comedy in front of them, in a way which most people can't. Whereas Luna is different. Luna is a far more competent painter in academic terms, but he's also interested in the way this... human comedy unfolds in front of him. The relationship of the artist to his subject is very specific. And some artists sort of let things float in front of them and are very cool about them. I can't imagine any of those portraits of Dutch colonial officials apart from his particular patron board were of any interest to Rodin Sutherland. They were just technical exercises which he had to do and earn a few pennies. But with Luna, when he's drawing or painting scenes of, if like a bohemian life, the life in Paris of the, and before that in Rome, of the intellectual, the artistic class, he sometimes identifies very strongly with what he sees. But as I was saying, while we know that Sala was very fluent in a number of European languages, particularly in German, and took part in cultural events which required some considerable level of German, or was perceived by his peers, or certainly his aristocratic peers, as being able to understand that kind of German. With Luna, we think we don't really, at least apart from one poem which seems to underlie, in French, which seems to underlie the Spoliarium, we don't really know what his access to European literature was. But apart from this one poem, we really don't know what, you know, Luna knew about that. I don't know, I'm speaking from ignorance. I don't know if our Filipino colleagues have found out or know. And these things are difficult to find out sometimes because you expect them to be in the libraries or the collections of libraries or whatever, or in letter references that these artists made, and particularly Luna, we would have thought, with his relationship with Rizal. But I don't know if they've been systematically analysed and have appeared. I mean, it does sometimes seem as if he's working with literary tropes in the representation of, shall we say, urban working class or poor people in who appear in some of the unpublished illustrations. Noli Me Tangere, the famous novel by Rizal, which he did illustrations for and which survived. But they're not, I mean, they're published, so you can't question the range of references that he might have involved himself in. This is important because there's a whole range of 19th century popular illustrations of people in dire straits in London and Paris and other cities, particularly London and Paris, the ones who had access to, which we know lay behind, interact with literary representations, but we don't know, I haven't seen any of that for analysis for Luna. If you knew what novels were on his shelf, then you could, and you could write down the dates, and you could see when, if you, often 19th century people write that when they bought a book, you can then see or at least make some hypotheses about relationship with literary themes. But as I say, apart from the Spoliarium where the literary source is known, I beg your pardon, where one of the literary references is known, and we know about the literature which was written in France, particularly by Anatole France, although I've never seen that discussed in the case of Luna, then you'd expect that some kinds of association, some kind of framing of the pictures would come from a literary knowledge, but we don't know. I don't know what they are. I hope some Philippine scholar does.
What would a general audience that perhaps doesn't know very much about Radin Saleh or Juan Luna get from attending a lecture such as this?
Radin Saleh and Juan Luna are put forward as some kind of hero, creator figures. And by looking at their work, in a set of those works, it's not only about those two famous paintings, people get an idea of how an artistic explorer of these discourses in the middle of the 19th century could have performed. And that's probably the best thing I'll get from it. They'll see how these people unfolded as artists and how they were related. I mean, I won't see the whole range of their work because I haven't given the whole range of their works, but particularly in the case of Luna. But they'll get an idea that maybe the past is not quite what we were told by. For Malaysians, I suppose, at this turning point in political history, which might be an intellectual turning point for people as well, is how do they reposition the production of modern Malaysian art, given that these two other cultures, very close by, have got such a long and rich history which Malaysian art doesn't have. Now, whether that's because we haven't looked at it or Malaysian scholars have not been allowed access to the princely collections, which I know into Malaysian princes' houses, but I've never seen. You know, these are the sorts of inquiries which would perhaps produce some kind of material for, or even perhaps answers. So, I mean, I would think that the relationship between these two artists is considerably interesting for Malaysians who might want to know more about the 19th century, you know, which is all buried in colonialism and so forth. But was it? Or how was it? What did artists do with colonial imagery and, you know, all that? For which there seem to be no answers. And you've got a huge problem about the 19th century, which, you know, I mean, I know because I've supervised students who've gone away and excavated bits of it. And you don't know what's there, let alone whether it agrees with your particular interpretive frame or not. It's not the matter. It's just I don't know what it is. And it must be there because we know bits of it are there, but we haven't actually seen it. So, yes, a retrospective exhibition drawn from the princely collections of Malaysian art in the 19th century is what I would like to see.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I've been speaking to John Clark, Professor Emeritus in Art History from the University of Sydney. John will be presenting a lecture tomorrow at the Ilham Gallery, Kuala Lumpur, called Radin Saleh and Juan Luna, A Comparative Perspective. For more information, visit ilhamgallery.com. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Front Row segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app, which is available on the App Store or Google Play. You've been listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.